London Column. This is Peter Watson once again presenting a weekly radio digest of items headlined or modest, but all selected for your interest and entertainment from the worldwide services of the BBC. London Column. War is an unpopular subject, but it figures in different aspects in each of our items in today's bill. A record in tapestry of one of the last war's climactic phases. An unexpected benefit that the Blitz brought to one ancient city in Britain. And the plans to prevent war, as voiced to us by your own Secretary of State, Mr. Dean Acheson. London has long been a principal place of meeting for the world's statesmen, but it's seldom that one of them makes such an agreeable impression as did Mr. Acheson. During the recent London conference of the North Atlantic Council, his words were broadcast nationwide. They were so warmly received and so cogent that they're worth hearing again. Here is an excerpt from Mr. Acheson's speech at the closing session of the conference.
I'm sure that all of my colleagues agree that we have made genuine progress. The ministers are resolved to secure the economic progress and prosperity of the peoples of their countries through close cooperation with each other and with other nations. To the immense resources of the free world and its industrial and scientific development, the peoples of the North Atlantic community bring the spiritual strength which comes from freedom. Conscious of the strength and of the will to peace of their countries, the ministers remain ready to seize any opportunity for achieving a genuine and lasting settlement of international problems. But for so long as some nations are not willing to cooperate in conditions of equality and mutual respect, they believe that the maintenance of peace and the defense of freedom require the organization of adequate military defense. The nations of the Atlantic Council are accordingly resolved by their united efforts to build up a system of defense equipped with modern weapons and capable of withstanding any external threat directed against any of them.
Then the official and confirming voices of Canada, Italy, of Holland and Denmark and France and Norway, of all the Atlantic Council member states. And finally, the endorsement of Mr. Acheson's words by Britain's Foreign Secretary, Mr. Ernest Bevy.
I think this association has three main characteristics. First, it's a peaceful association. In the past, we've had military alliances, either born of war or directed to war. Our object now is to fortify peace, not merely prepare for war. The very foundation and purpose of the Atlantic Pact is to bring these freedom-loving peoples together in such a way that they can prevent another war. Secondly, it is an equal association. These 12 nations, great and small, and the smallest nation among us is equal with the greatest, all contribute equally according their means to the common effort. Thirdly, it is a free association. Pessimists sometimes say that free democracies are doomed because by their very nature they can never compete in efficiency and singleness of purpose with totalitarianism. Well, I think the last war disproved that. And we representatives of 12 free democracies assembled at this table say most emphatically that that is not so.
Now, wars in the past have provided artistic inspiration. For example, the ancient Bayeux tapestries which recorded the Norman invasion of England 900 years ago. And now, a modern tapestry portraying invasion the other way, the Allied invasion of the Norman beaches in 1944. You in America have just been having a chance to see a piece of British tapestry, a carpet worked by the deft fingers of our own Queen Mother herself. This other, a tapestry of D-Day, has been worked by the women of Southampton at the suggestion of Elsie Sandal, who would like to tell you something about it.
The idea for this D-Day embroidery came to me 3 years ago when new windows were unveiled in Southampton's ancient Bargate to replace those destroyed in the war. I remember looking through one of the latticed windows down into Southampton's High Street. This High Street has been a highway of history. It has resounded to the marching feet of our armies from the days of the Crusades to the time of Edward III and the Black Prince, who passed along it in 1346 on their way to Cressy, and again to 1415 when the soldiers of Henry V passed under the Bargate to embark for Agincourt. Century after century, the men and women of Southampton have seen troop movements through their fort, culminating in D-Day, June 6, 1944. Suddenly I thought, could not the women of Southampton weave a tapestry of their town on that day of days? Only those who saw it can have full comprehension of its magnitude, the endless streams of men and vehicles, of guns, tanks, jeeps rattling and roaring through the streets, the barrage balloons clustered over port and town, flight after flight of aeroplanes flashing pinpoints of silver in sudden gleams of sunshine through the clouds. The whole scene must have been a sight unparalleled in all our 2,000 years of recorded history.
Some artistic achievement to war then. But it seems we also owe some archaeological discovery to the German bombs that rained down and laid waste 9 acres of the ancient cathedral city of Canterbury, scene of pilgrimage in Chaucer's day and of Luftwaffe visitation under Hitler's so-called Baedeker bombing program, aimed at every British cathedral city. Well, those devastated acres of Canterbury will be rebuilt. But we now know more about that land than ever before, as René Cutforth can tell you. That 9-acre patch is virtually one large bomb site, the result of 35 raids when 445 high-explosive bombs and more than 10,000 incendiaries fell on the city. 800 buildings were totally destroyed, among them, on this 9-acre patch, the timbered Tudor cottage which had been the birthplace of the poet Christopher Marlowe. But if the bombing wiped out the city's recent and picturesque past, it uncovered evidence of another, more ancient past which has made a first-class contribution to the knowledge of this country's early history. Hundreds of years before the Romans came here, Canterbury had been occupied by a Celtic tribe. And before that, even, in the Iron Age, people had settled there. It's been lived in continuously for many more than 2,000 years, as many thousands of coins and pots and brooches and pins uncovered during the last 5 years testify. An excavation committee began to explore this ancient past even before the war ended, using a labor force of volunteers. It is still carrying out this work and has been able to map much of the Roman and the medieval towns of Canterbury. And during the last 3 weeks, the most remarkable find of all has turned up. It's the remains of a pagan Saxon settlement as early as the middle of the 5th century AD. And the evidence seems to show that the Saxons may have been using Roman coins and living in a Romanized civilization. The discovery is exciting because in most cities, this period of history between the end of the Roman occupation and the beginning of the Saxon conquest is simply a blank space in the archaeological record. Postscript is still a matter of war, a matter of one day in one man's war, that of London columnist Alan Melville.
Alan, this is Alan Melville speaking. For one person to reminisce at length on his own individual exploits in the last war is generally regarded, at any rate in this country, as bad form. When two or three people do so, it ceases to be bad form and becomes just a bore. When the reminiscing is done by large numbers, it is then called a regimental reunion dinner and is probably the biggest bore of all. Well, listening to the lady from Southampton and realizing that, bless my soul, this is the 6th anniversary of D-Day, I'm going to break the rules and talk about my personal experiences on the eve of that event. Experiences which, like all my war experiences, were undistinguished, inglorious, and marked by the palpitating rather than the purple heart. Because it was from Southampton 6 years ago, on what we old Boers refer to as D-1, that I managed with some difficulty to drive a jeep up the ramp of a landing craft known as LST-302. I had forgotten to take the handbrake off, and the embarkation was achieved to the accompaniment of terrible noises, much ribaldry from the sailors, and a strong smell of burning rubber. We had been penned down for some 6 weeks before D-Day in a very lovely little village in Hampshire called Hambledon. It was a glorious spring that year. The lilac and the laburnum trees were bent double with the weight of their blossom, which showed which side nature was on, for under almost every tree in the south of England, a tank or a Bren gun carrier or something was hidden by the bloom. The villagers went about their daily chores, pretending that they hadn't noticed that anything out of the ordinary was happening in their midst, at the same time wearing the superior expressions of people who are in on a secret and proud to be trusted. And eventually we moved off, and I have no doubt that the good lady of Southampton, whom you heard just now, was among those who behaved so beautifully on that occasion. Southampton and Portsmouth and the other embarkation towns must have been pretty blasé about convoys by then, but it was obvious that this was no ordinary convoy. This was it. Yet not a word was said about forthcoming events. There were no cheers, no bands, and however much they may have wanted to, for self-imposed reasons of security, no one wished anyone luck. But every time the convoys halted on their way down to the dock, cups of tea appeared at front doors. To the agitation of officers and NCOs, the troops were invited in for a last wash and brush up. The men gave the children their chocolate rations, and I remember finding a little shop where the assistant let me have some soap without coupons. "Don't tell the other," she said, leaning over the counter and whispering furtively as though she was Mata Hari. She must have said it to almost the entire British Army. At any rate, they all came out of the shop and clambered back into their vehicles armed with coupon-free soap. The jeep in front of mine had a life-size portrait of Donald Duck painted on it and was immensely popular with the children. One of them, a minx of about 7 in a scarlet swimsuit, formed a close attachment with the driver of the jeep, a corporal in the East Riding Yeomanry, and announced her intention of marrying him and living in his jeep. And at last, she and the other children were dragged away from the vehicles and the convoy moved on. A few people waved from their windows, that was all. And the next civilians we saw a few hours later were the black-garbed, terrified peasants of what had once been a village called Lyon-sur-Mer in Normandy. Goodbye.
And it's goodbye, too, from this edition of London Column, a radio digest produced by Stephen Eckard, presented by Peter Watson, and which came to you in the North American service of the BBC. That was London Column, a transcribed program. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.